This week, about 100 years ago, in the wake of the Russian Revolution and the pogroms that followed, millions of Jews in Eastern Europe became Soviet Jews. But what really is a Soviet Jew, and how does that history affect Jews today? That's what I talk about with UW professor Sasha Senderovich. I'm Lev Gringaus, and welcome to The Jews Are Tired, your podcast about Jewish news. As of the release of this podcast, it's day 344 of Russia's war in Ukraine. If you want to donate to help Ukraine, there's a link in the podcast notes with resources to do that. Okay, welcome back to The Jews Are Tired in 2023. I'm sorry for the delay and not publishing in January. There's a lot going on at Jewfolk, including our ongoing expansion to Cincinnati with Cincy Jewfolk, our new partnership with Jay, the Jewish News of Northern California, to produce The Bagel Report, a podcast about Jewish pop culture, and our brand new Jewfolk TikTok, where we are going to try our hand and our faces at video. Links to all of that are in the podcast notes in case you're interested in learning more. But here we are in 2023, and for me, for this podcast, I'm finding myself drawn a little more to people and episodes that aren't so bound to timely news and are a little more about understanding broader Jewish ideas and trends. This episode is in that vein. Sasha Senderovich is an assistant professor in the Department of Slavic Language and Literatures at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he and I have been following each other on Twitter for a while now, part of this network of Russian-speaking Jews on various social media platforms who naturally just end up finding each other. I'd been thinking of interviewing him for a while, and the perfect opportunity came up with a book he published last year called How the Soviet Jew Was Made, which looks at literature and film from the 1920s and 30s to understand how Jews became not just Soviet, but particularly this sort of figure of the Soviet Jew. By the way, How the Soviet Jew Was Made was also a finalist in the National Jewish Book Awards, so all the more so, go buy it and read it, just like I did. Links are in the podcast notes to get your copy, and a review of the book by famous Soviet-American writer Gary Steingart is also in the podcast notes if you want to get a taste of the book before buying. Now, this book is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, thinking about the Soviet Jew isn't just some intellectual exercise. An entire movement, the movement to free Soviet Jewry, arguably the most successful organizing effort of American Jewry ever, revolved around an image and idea about Soviet Jews, the people that Americans were trying to save. And for many American Jews who lived through that period or grew up in it, there are certain perceptions and stereotypes that stick around. Some maybe are pretty accurate, others less so, but to generalize, to many American Jews, the Soviet Jew is not religious, doesn't know anything about Judaism, to the point of being like a child, and maybe backwardly still holds on to some Soviet traditions, like having a New Year's tree. But that conception is really flat. There's not a lot of detail or depth to it, and it also flattens much of the backstory of how Jews became Soviet Jews and how Judaism was both discarded but also kept in different and sometimes unrecognizable ways, even in the Soviet Union. And that story says something about Jewishness and about Jews like me, Russian-speaking Jews who come from Soviet Jewish families. For those who don't know, my mom's family is from Ukraine and my dad's is from Belarus. So I obviously can't avoid it. Senderovich and his book are of huge personal interest to me. The drive to understand myself as a Russian-speaking Jew, or whatever I and my family are now 40 years after we left the Soviet Union, it's what drew me to journalism in the first place. And honestly, I'm almost starting to identify more with the moniker of Soviet Jew and the culture and history that denotes than Russian-speaking Jew when, out of disgust for Russia's war in Ukraine, I'm finding myself speaking less Russian and steering away from a lot of Russian language stuff. Maybe that's a subject for another episode, but for a lot of kids like me, I feel like our families talk a lot about the Soviet Union overall and what life was like after World War II and the Holocaust, but we hear a lot less about the Russian Revolution and how our families were shaped in the 1920s and 30s. So speaking to Senderovich and reading his book is a really interesting experience for me, but it also gets very weird and complicated very quickly. which you'll hear about as I kind of confront Senderovich about that in this episode. But the final connection I want to make before getting to the conversation itself is that I think this history and Senderovich's book is also more relevant to many American Jews than it might seem. There was a flood of Eastern European Jews who came to the United States to escape the pogroms that followed the Russian Revolution, or to escape the then nascent Soviet Union. But just as those forces and Soviet-specific forces shaped the Soviet Jew, those events are also part of the history of some of today's Ashkenazi American Jews whose ancestors came to the U.S. in the late 1910s or early 1920s. And that means they were also shaped in part by what happened there. And this story of tragedy and uncertainty and violence, but also reshaping into a new society, feels extremely part of the Jewish narrative and how we understand who we are. And that also ties into Senderovich's research focus on literature and film and the cultural way these changes happen and are depicted. And these changes also happened across languages as Russian and Yiddish intermixed and influenced each other in a new national project. So lots to think about. Senderovich mentions a few other books like Late Stalinism and Legacy of Blood, which are linked in the podcast notes. And his website is also there if you want to see his touring schedule and hear him speak more about this. But I won't get in your way any longer. Our conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Enjoy. So just to start out for listeners, why write this book? Let's start with the biggest possible question, how the Soviet Jew was made, and why do it through the lens of culture like writing and film?
You know, I've been sort of thinking about Jews from Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, for some number of years, and kind of giving talks and sort of writing papers and talking to people. Kind of by sort of thinking about this and answering people's questions, I sort of at some point about maybe 6 or 7 years ago started thinking about how, you know, Soviet Jews didn't grow on trees. There was something about the making of Jews Soviet and of making of the Soviet Jews that was itself an interesting question to me. So this book, once upon a time, parts of this book were my dissertation. When I was in graduate school. And then I kind of abandoned it for many years and sort of came back later. But by the time I came back to it, I had thought about more kind of recent material, which was literature by immigrants, Soviet-born Jewish immigrants who were beginning to write in English in the early 2000s, people like Gary Steingart, David Busmozges, Anya Lubimich, and others. And I was, you know, reading their works extensively and sort of beginning to write about them. And eventually kind of dawned on me that what some of them were doing were responding to, you know, kind of American Jewish questions about who they were, and that their answers were kind of constructing a kind of composite figure of the Soviet Jew that sort of came to exist through their work and through their literary texts. So around 2016, I wrote this article on this contemporary literature, kind of, you know, turn of the 21st century, trying to think about how people like Gary Steinger and others were responding to the way that American Jews had thought about Jews from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, through the Soviet Jewry movement, etc. When I did that, I realized that, okay, so if I'm kind of thinking about this when it comes to contemporary material, is kind of became almost natural to me. And I saw myself in that story, I suppose, you know, autobiographically as well, as one of the people who also immigrated from the former Soviet Union. But then my work in graduate school was on the early Soviet period, the 1920s and the 1930s. And that's when I realized that this is a similar kind of question that there was to be asked about that early period. So it first began for me as a kind of backstory, right? Trying to understand how did the figure that people like David Busmozges and Gary Steingart and Anya Lubimich and Irina Rain and others came to write about at the turn of the 21st century, how did it first come to be before they knew about it? But then once I kind of returned to my material about the 20s and the 30s, I was really no longer thinking about the contemporary resonances necessarily, but instead trying to do a kind of cultural historical excavation of what the different attributes of the Soviet Jew were. And why literature and film and materials of that nature? There also, there's some literary sketches, there's some journalism, things like that. But so I'm not an historian. Historians have written about different parts of the subject, and I engage with their work, right? So there's a wonderful book by Elisa Demporad about Jews of Minsk, for example, that does look at the same time period, so the kind of first couple of decades after the revolution, and looks at local archives in the city of Minsk. So you can tell a certain kind of story that's based on archival records. So for me, the archive is the literary and cultural, and I developed an approach to it that could help me kind of navigate novels that were written, short stories that were written, not from the vantage point of the present and of me writing about it now in, 2022, but rather as they were written and published at the time, to try to reconstruct the broader contexts for this literature so that my archive of literary texts became, to me, as somebody who thinks with literature and with film, kind of the way to answer that question, to think about questions like representation and questions like, different kind of literary devices and whatnot that can animate the story in a different way than an archival record, from kind of sort of institutional archives could.
Starting with sort of contemporary responses to what American Jews think about Soviet Jews, to then you talked about setting aside that relevance, but I still want to ask, the Soviet Jew that you talk about is different than the Soviet Jew that does exist in the American Jewish imagination, which is still heavily influenced by the movement to free Soviet Jewry in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But I still want to ask, in putting this book together, was there any sense of actively wanting to reimagine for people today who and what the Soviet Jew was? Even though you sort of focused in and set aside that relevance, that still has to be context to you writing this book now about this material from back then. And maybe this is just me, but to read your book honestly sort of meant setting aside almost everything of what being a Soviet Jew means today, if that makes any sense.
Tell me what you mean. Actually, I'm kind of curious. Like, what does that mean for you?
In the sense of, I think, I've got a later question about this, so I don't want to get too far into it now, but in the sense of when I think about my family story and when I think about Soviet Jewry, it's concurrent with the sort of the way American Jews think about us as well. The formative experiences that we talk about are oppression in the Soviet Union, gulags after World War II, Stalin's death is sort of the beginner marker to like contemporary Soviet Jewish history, and then sort of immigration and the rest of it. There's almost no actual discussion of what came before, except for a few fleeting, from the shtetl here or bits like that. On one hand, reading your book, I was always thinking about that context of like what came next. Obviously, just a whole lot of things. But at the same time, to fully immerse myself in the time period you're talking about, I had to sort of set that aside and go, well, everything I know about Soviet Jews is not what's happening here, including my own story and the way I've heard about it.
I think sometimes I joke that, maybe this is part one. Right? Maybe there's a sequel that I have to write. Right, how the Soviet Jew was made, part two. And part two would begin with Stalin's death. People right now, there are quite a few scholars who are working on the war and the Holocaust. So I think that these kinds of questions are being answered, but I think there's more to be done kind of systematically, kind of death of Stalin to the end of the Soviet Union. Let me start out with because I'm a literature scholar, I think with literary texts. So there's a text I don't write about, but I teach in my courses on Soviet Jews. There's a story from the 1990s by Lyudmila Ulitskaya, which is called «2 марта того же года», on the 2nd of March of that same year, with this kind of obvious allusion to the year being 1953 and the death of Stalin on March 5th. But, according to all kinds of lore and fact, possibly 3 days earlier. In any case, the protagonist of the novel is somebody who then is 12 years old, but she lives with her grandparents and the great-grandfather who is dying, at the same time in the story. And this great, if you do the math, this great-grandfather is, from the shtetl, probably born in the 1860s, and is now in sort of late Stalin era Moscow in 1953. So, and that figure, you know, he tells stories from the past and dies, right? So and Ulitska writes this in the 1990s, herself being the child who was the age of her protagonist, 12, right, in 1953, taking that story kind of forward to the present. So who is that elderly character, right? The sort of this dying Jew, old Jew, who is kind of present in the 1950s and, you know, through storytelling, still present, right, in the 1990s and into the 21st century. I think in some ways, my book is an attempt to understand that character, who by the time we get to later narratives is reduced to, you know, the dying bed, right? The sort of the sick bed, and some kind of very random bits and pieces of stories that he or she might put together, but not really kind of tell extensively about their life. If we think about the American Jews, thinking about the Soviet Jews during the Cold War, they relate to the Soviet Jews through the lack, the supposed lack of Judaism, right? Of observance, of the kind of the different things that don't translate into American Jewish experience of kind of synagogue-oriented communal structures, not particularly observant necessarily, but kind of still kind of structured around some nominal sense of Judaic observance. And the Soviet Jews are not that at that point in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But at the same time, you know, the story is not that like they were one day religious and all living in the shtetl, and then like they became something else, right? There's a process of them becoming something else. And that process isn't necessarily toward the point at which American Jews meet them in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There's more to what it means to be a Soviet Jew than simply lacking in these sort of identifiable traits of normative Judaism. So how do we get at that? It's very difficult because the stories are so idiosyncratic. Those of us who come from that background know how idiosyncratic they are with sort of bits and pieces of family lore. So it's looking at the, you know, archive of literary fiction and film and short stories and journalism and things like that from the time that you can begin to piece together what those attributes are. And so not just the sort of disappearance of Judaism, right? That's not the only marker of Soviet Jews, which is how I think mostly they become known. And that's why they need to be saved so they could be made whole and sort of be proper Jews. And what I mean, I have air quotes around all of these terms, obviously. So I think I don't ask that question in this book. Right. This is I really try to think about the 20s and 30s on their own, but I can see what you mean, right? That to a reader today, you do have these questions because what you know about what American Jewish readers know about Soviet Jews comes from a later period. So it's actually great, right? That you kind of have to put as a reader to put aside what you know, because then you're getting the story that isn't what you suspect and it doesn't yet lead to this point of encounter later in the 20th century.
So now to get a little bit more into the content of the book itself and to showcase to listeners sort of what your approach is, keeping in mind, again, I don't want to give too much away on this podcast because listeners should really go buy the book and read it, link in the podcast notes. But I just want to focus on one particular literary element that you cover early on in the book, Gothic themes. Why, in the wake of the Russian Civil War, did Jewish writers adopt Gothic themes to tell stories about Jews and pogroms? At face value, this seems like a slightly strange, also overly Christian-y approach.
So if one thinks about kind of my book trying to paint this picture of the Soviet Jew, I'm painting a little bit in one corner, then I'm painting a little bit in the other corner. And then like, by the time you're done, there's something like a canvas. So the first, you know, bit that I'm working on is the Civil War after the revolution, or the so-called Civil War. There's sort of different ways of thinking about this period, but roughly 1918 to 1921, which among other things came with, you know, a hefty dose of pogroms in the territory of what is now Ukraine. So it's also kind of uncanny to be thinking about this, you know, now because some of the place names are recognizable from news reports. And in any case, in this chapter, as in every chapter, I rely on a central text to help me tell a story. And this text is a novel by Dovid Birgelson, who was a Yiddish writer, who by 1920 had been a kind of a very well-known Yiddish writer, a modernist author. He was from Ukraine. And in 1921, via Moscow, he actually ended up moving to Berlin, in part to kind of run away from the violence of pogroms. So he lived in Berlin in the 1920s, all the way until 1934, actually. This novel called Midas Hadin in Yiddish, or Judgment, which I translated together with Harriet Merav, which readers can also read in English now. It's a novel that's set on the border between Ukraine, which the Bolsheviks are trying to control, but aren't very steady, or it's not clear yet whether they'll be able to, and Poland, which by then was a new state after the First World War. So we're right on the borderlands, where in this kind of unclear territory, surrounded by dark forests, and the Bolshevik secret police, the CK, established a border outpost on the territory of a ruined monastery. And the main protagonist is a non-Jewish Czechist, Filipov, who presides over this outpost near a shtetl, where there are many Jews who, you know, kind of suffer the violence over the time. So this Filipov character has wounds on his neck. He spends most of the novel in bed. Kind of when he comes out, he sort of cuts this very sort of threatening figure, speaks in this hoarse voice. So this combination of, you know, dark woods, ruined monastery or castle of some kind, monsters, these are all kind of attributes of the Gothic novel, a genre that proliferated after the French Revolution. The scholars who've worked about on the Gothic novel, and these were mainly in, you know, there were mainly British titles, which were set somewhere in Italy or somewhere on the continent at kind of an earlier time. And they were about these castles that were haunted by monsters. So it was all kind of the way that people thought about this was this fear of the, around the, what happened in the French Revolution, right? The sort of the deposing of the monarchy, the execution of the emperor by the riffraff that's not supposed to come to power. So there's a kind of a haunting in these texts about the fear this might happen somewhere else. So Gothic novels, they're haunted by something that's kind of not completed, that might come back and kind of cause further destruction. So what I was very interested in with this novel is Birgelson, he wrote it in the middle of the 1920s, where he lived in Berlin, which was full of refugees from various places, including from Ukraine, including of many Jews who were running away from violence. So, and it was a place where there were so many people and so many cultural figures who were aware that they were in the presence of this kind of mass migration, that there was a lot of kind of collecting of testimonies by pogrom survivors and refugees. So they begin to publish in Yiddish, also in Russian, right there in Berlin, right in the 1920s, these sort of collections of testimonies, early historical works about the pogroms in Ukraine. So he's surrounded by, you know, stories of survivors. So he knows how things end, right, as a writer in the mid-1920s. But I'm very interested in how, at the same time, he begins to write this novel that he sets in 1920, before that violence is over, right? So kind of right in the middle of the Civil War, right in the middle of pogroms, in this territory that's very hard to figure out where exactly it is. The place names are changed. And what's Gothic about it to me is that he tries to come up with something like a mindset of Jews in the shtetl who don't know what the end of the story is, who live next to this outpost of the Bolshevik secret police, and they project this sort of strength and power that they're there to stay. But in fact, the hold on power is tenuous, and the Bolsheviks were known to Jews at the time as mostly protecting them from the violence of pogroms from various other forces, including Ukrainian nationalists, whites. There's sort of many different groupings. But it's not clear that with this dying monster in a monastery, this is not the right kind of Bolshevik protector. And so there's this fear that the violence that they'd already experienced might come back, right? And it does in the end of the novel. but it's kind of always there, kind of lurking underneath. So to me, that was this kind of haunting that the story of the Soviet Jew begins not with some like decisive victory of the Bolsheviks, who then decisively say, Jews, you need to be this and not that. But instead, right, it's a sort of unclear process of where allegiances belong and in the middle of violence, including violence that already happened and that might still come back if things turn out a different way. I read this novel as a Gothic novel. This novel has not been written about very much, and I go into details in the book of why that was, but it hadn't been thought of as a Gothic novel. But when I came back to read it for my book, after already translating it to the colleague and kind of knowing it very closely, I also realized that it was coming out at a time when there were many Russian language novels already by the mid-1920s about the Soviet secret police, about the Bolshevik secret police. There's a kind of a cult of the Czechist already by the mid-1920s. There were novels from the very early 1920s that were already published by the time Bjørgensen came to write his. And many of them were written in this Gothic mode. Another scholar, Maureen McGuire, had written this whole book about the Soviet Gothic, including about the Chicago Gothic. So I went in and I read all these novels, which are, you know, terrible, about the Chicago from the 1920s, to also kind of understand that, you know, Bjørgensen knew them, right? I mean, he was living in, he was writing in Yiddish, but he was very well versed in Russian too, trying to understand what literarily it meant to write that kind of text. And he was also another part of the puzzle. He was also living in Berlin, like I said, right? In Berlin in the mid-1920s, this is, you know, German expressionism, the golem, the, you know, Nosferatu. It's like the all the films that are kind of associated with German expressionism from the 1920s, which Bjørgensen, you know, undoubtedly went to see, which are, you know, also full of monsters. Dr. Caligari, you know, they're kind of full of this sort of aesthetically, very similar to how Bjørgensen writes, this kind of jagged narrative where things aren't clear and things are kind of mixed up. And so the kind of the composite of these things is why I gravitate towards this theme.
So let me flip things over a little bit differently. Focus in your book is a lot of the time on literature, but there's also a distinct mention of critics, also Jewish, also writing in Yiddish, often dissatisfied with the writings you discuss in the book. One name that keeps coming up is Yasha Bronstein, often criticizing writers for not being supportive enough of the revolution and their writings and for things being too Jewish. So I want to ask you, sort of, as you're writing this book, what did you sort of see of Soviet Jewish criticism and how that influenced the imagination around Soviet Jews? Because it feels, from reading your book, that these critics were the ones really hewing to the party line and defining a strict sense of how Soviet Jews should be. And those aspirations are also sort of part of this larger story.
Importantly, right, I write about texts and films that were published and produced and released, right, and circulating. There's another kind of Cold War influenced approach, not just to Soviet Jewish culture, but the Soviet culture more broadly, that a lot of the things that, you know, kind of Western audiences know are the things that were not published, right, hidden away, published abroad, you know, written by dissidents, not for mass circulation. So if you look at the syllabi of, you know, Soviet literature from, you know, even 20 years ago, it would be things that Soviet people actually didn't read because they couldn't. So then there's this kind of another prejudice, I think, in sort of Western conception of Soviet culture more broadly, is that things that were published in the Soviet Union were therefore always tainted. To have had a book published in the Soviet Union, something needs to be wrong with the book, right? To be wrong in the Western imagination, right? It made some compromise with the regime. And so like all the best books were banned, but then if all the best books were banned, nobody read them, right? So this is the dilemma, right? How do you write about, in this case, I'm trying to figure out the Soviet Jew. So I'm trying to write about the Soviet Jew who like had books that he could read or she could read and think about. So then you, of course, you know, the sort of literature I write about was published, was not censored, was, you know, existed. And because it was read, it was criticized, including by doctrinaire critics like this Yasha Bronstein character who, you know, does pop up a lot in the book. It was prolific. And what's interesting is that when you read doctrinaire critics who see how works by writers at the time, which are published, which later Western critics might see as compromised because they're published. If you get a doctrinaire critic in there, he is going to point out, and does, how no, they're not proper Soviet works. And I'm going to tell you why, right? And there are various reasons. You know, he, with the novel that we just talked about, David Bergelson's Judgment, he thinks that Bergelson is being very tongue-in-cheek, making fun of the revolution, that instead of describing it the way that the revolution needs to be described, he's doing it in a very Bergelsonian way, right? He's too modernist. He's too complicated. It's not clear what you're supposed to think, right? So the novel, therefore, is something is wrong with it. It's not a good Soviet novel, which is the complete opposite of what, and I write about this in the book too, of what some of the Cold War era American Jewish critics have to say about this book, which they think is absolutely pro-Bolshevik, right? So like these things don't meet. So you kind of need to read, you need to take these critics for what they write, right? Because they are trying to define what a novel should be and when it diverges somewhat from this kind of doctrinaire script. If a doctrinaire critic can point out what isn't quite Bolshevik in a supposedly Bolshevik novel, then we get, you know, like a possibility, right, that other readers also read it in some way that was, you know, not simply clear cut, right? These are complicated texts that they're, you know, as all literary texts are. So it became very important for me to basically read criticism as a, from the time as a primary source as well, alongside the, you know, literary texts themselves. And also to read, you know, criticism that's more contemporary. I mean, I don't do it that often, but occasionally, right, with novels like Bergelson, about which so little is written, I'm interested in more contemporary writing that does exist as a kind of primary source to kind of try to think between the lines of all of these ways of thinking about the text, to think about how they tell us something that maybe all of the critics were had too many blindfolds to see. And it's by reading them all as primary sources that we can try to piece together a certain picture. So it's very, so there's another reason why it's really interesting for me to read contemporary views throughout the book, not just in that one chapter, because of how these texts circulate. So the Yiddish texts that I write about, so about half the book is on texts that were originally published in Yiddish, but half on things that are originally in Russian. And in various ways, there's a cross-pollination between the two languages throughout. But in particular with the Yiddish texts that I write about, they were serialized. So they were published in periodical press over a course of many years in Yiddish periodicals. Bergelson wanted to be published everywhere he could be published because it paid honoraria. So parts of this novel were published in Soviet press. Some would be published in journal that he himself edited in Berlin. Some would come out in Poland, right? So parts of the same novel that now exists between two covers and eventually was published as a book, right? Were actually published initially in very different contexts, political contexts, cultural contexts, but sort of circulated in this kind of greater, you know, Yiddish Republic of Letters. And those texts moved between, you know, America and Poland and Palestine, right? So it's like, it's sort of very interesting to think about these texts as not being confined to any one area, but rather the Soviet Jew that emerges in those pages as a kind of, you know, international project that, you know, kind of people are trying to grapple with. Films that I write about, I'm very interested in how these Soviet propaganda films, you know, were reviewed in New York, where they were shown in movie theaters, in part to try to entice Jews who had left the Pale of Settlement, the Russian Empire before the revolution, settled in America, you know, and were finding themselves in the 1930s in the middle of Great Depression, kind of interested in the Soviet Union. So these films were there, kind of reviewed in English as, you know, what they were trying to show about life in the Soviet Union. So it's fascinating to kind of think about also at the time, right? So contemporary reviews. So it sort of adds to my sense about these texts as my primary sources as kind of living texts, living a life at the time with which many people are engaged. So they're not like holed away somewhere in someone's drawer, and no one's thinking about them until they're discovered miraculously. And now we learn, you know, and that's also fine. You know, like there's lots of great literature that's found this way. I don't mean to diss that at all, but I'm interested in the text that kind of had a life at the time that people were arguing about, right? And they were sort of thinking about. And it's because of that discussion that we can piece together contours of, you know, what Soviet Jews became.
So now I want to get a little weird and a little personal, and bear with me, both you and listeners, because this I normally don't frame a question with this much, but I've got a big paragraph written to frame this question, so bear with me for a moment. This is going to sound weird, but as I've been reading your book, I keep having this thought in the back of my head. On one hand, this is really significant history. What you write about covers transition for my family and many others that is always in the background, but not really discussed that much. My great-grandparents, for example, my dad's grandparents, spoke Russian with a Yiddish accent, which is such a simple anecdote, but also denotes the interplay of Russian and Yiddish and all of these transitions that you cover to sort of the Sovietism that Jews went through that we don't really talk about. On the other hand, though, and this is sort of to bring up part of the conversation from earlier, all of the forces post-Russian Revolution that defined the Soviet Jew feel really irrelevant in the face of World War II and the Holocaust, which completely rewrote the Soviet national narrative and the story for Jews. You know, the uncertainty about Bolshevik power before World War II is replaced, you know, and maybe this is just in my mind, but replaced by reliance and belief in the Soviet state as the great rebuilder. Like I just have in my mind memory of my late grandfather. He always talked about how, like, you know, as a kid stranded in Kharkiv at the end of the war, Kharkiv is a city in Ukraine for listeners, there came a Soviet edict that, like, all kids will go to school, and all kids went to school, and, it, you know, they got an education, things were rebuilt, and there you go, you know. So how do you square the relevance of the history you cover with the complete reshaping of Soviet Jewishness that happened in the 1940s?
So you, by reading my book, it seems like, stumbled upon a kind of a major problem. How we view, we're accustomed to viewing the Soviet period is somehow like one continuous story, right? But instead, it's a story with a rupture, right? And that rupture is the war in the middle. So towards the end of, you know, I think in the epilogue, right, I begin to grapple with this question. So when I was writing the epilogue, I was very influenced by what then was, you know, kind of a brand new book by a wonderful scholar of Soviet culture, Yevgeny Dobrynka, which is this massive tome. It's a book about late Stalinism. And in that book, he grapples with the fact that what most Western readers know about Stalinism comes from the 1930s, right? Industrialization, the collectivization, 1937, but much less about post-war Stalinism, which people think of as some kind of afterthought, but it's, Dobrynka says, is a really its own separate period of Soviet history. Why? Because Stalin turns the war into an event in Soviet history that replaces the magnitude of the 1917 revolution. The 1945, the victory over Nazi Germany, is a foundational event. It allows Stalin, who emerged to the top of power in the 1920s in the shadow of Lenin, who led, you know, the Bolsheviks to the revolution in 1917, finally allows Stalin to come into his own, right? He is now the great victor, right? And the great kind of refounder of the Soviet state. So, and I find it's very compelling, right? Because something important really does change. After 1945, 1917 kind of dims in importance. Right, it becomes more removed from public imagination. And eventually, and to this day, right, 1945 is at the forefront of the very Russo-centric myth of kind of the Soviet greatness that now kind of under Putin passes into Russian greatness. Back to your question. Right, about, so you're absolutely right, right? Sort of you as a reader, you intuited something very important that I think scholarship is beginning to deal with, how we tell that story. So I'm very cognizant of this in the book in various ways, right? So I grapple with the question, why am I telling the story of 1917 to roughly 1938-39? And you can think about it with regards to your question, that it's, you know, the story that I'm telling is bracketed by two periods of violence, right? The violence of pogroms right after the revolution on the one end, and then, of course, the beginning of the war and the Holocaust on the other end. Those markers, date markers, are also important because I'm writing about, there's a map in the beginning of the book that outlines the sort of territory of the Pale of Settlement that ceased existing in 1917, but it overlays it onto the borders of the Soviet Union as they arose, actually 100 years almost to the day ago, December 1922. So as a kind of a presence, right? So the Pale of Settlement continued existing. So those borders get rewritten again in 1939 with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, when Hitler and Stalin divide up some of the same borderlands. It didn't feel right to think about the war as the final chapter of this book, because the war really is a separate book. One of the ways when I wrote this book, there are some other books about Soviet Jewish culture, including Soviet Jewish literature, that do a kind of century full sweep, right? So there's a fantastic book by my colleague and co-translator, Harriet Murav, called Music from a Speeding Train, which is a story of Soviet Jewish, Russian Jewish, Soviet Yiddish literature through the entirety of the Soviet period, right? So it has the sort of chapters on the war alongside chapters on the earlier periods and later periods. I wanted to take a slower time, right? I wanted to begin, again, if I were to write more books, right? I want to think about later periods, but I wanted to think kind of very carefully about the first 20 years, precisely because of what you're asking about, that what comes later is so shattering, right? That we can't, the earlier period becomes a kind of a backstory. And it's more than a backstory. I want to think about it on its own terms so that we can understand people who would then experience the war and the Holocaust, many of whom will perish, but many of whom who will not, right? Something that's kind of very odd about the Holocaust in the Soviet Union is that massive numbers of Soviet Jews are killed in the Holocaust on Soviet territory. And at the same time, more than half survive in evacuation, you know, in places away from where the Germans occupy. And then some return, right, to the territories that they had left. So there's a war is a rupture. But unlike with the Jews of Salonika or the Jews of many Polish cities, right, many other places, it's not a complete erasure, right? It's a rupture. But over that rupture, there's this weird continuity. So I think to me, it's very important to understand how things started on their own terms, so we're not backshadowing what came later into this earlier period. Not because I'm trying to deny that what happened was terrible, right? But that, that people who lived that time, you know, they didn't know. Maybe some felt, right? But this is speculation. And you can detect it in texts for sure. But their lives were not all about eventually dying in the war and dying in the Holocaust, right? It was about sort of trying to figure out what those lives were about. It's a difficult question. And that's why, like, you know, hopefully my work isn't done here, right? That's, I want to understand these later periods. So, you know, there probably is two more books for me to write, right? Right, one on the war on its own, and then what kind of post-war, post-Stalin.
And I should also say, sort of both for you and for listeners, I mean, in asking that question, it's also, in some sense, it's existential as well, because this history is obviously important to me because it's a personal story about my family as well. And this sort of, it's very interesting to feel like, oh, you know, my great-grandfather at this time in Minsk was probably sort of a contemporary of Bergelson, was aware of all these things. But also even filling in like iconic Soviet animation like Chiburashka was based on Minsk before the war. Much of the city was destroyed, and up to, I think, a third or a huge portion of it was Jewish at the time. So, and a lot of Soviet animation was also, they were Jewish animators sort of reconstructing and talking about that. So there's some sense of filling in like, oh, maybe then they were, you know, referencing stories like the Zimdin Yanners and sort of all these other books and filling in for what they remembered. But at the same time, there's still a sense of, how do I make sense of myself and what comes next, given this story and given the rupture of the Holocaust and World War II, but then also of immigration and sort of what came next? So it's really weird to sort of engage with your book. I do have to, in a good sense, weird.
And it's really interesting for me to hear this, right? Because So, I mean, the book is new, so not that many people read it yet. So it's wonderful to speak with each new reader because there are not that many of them yet. And you are, you know, every reader is unique and you're unique in your own way. You know, as a person who was born to Soviet Jewish immigrants already in the States, and you kind of are very interested in that story. So it's really fascinating to hear what you bring to this. So, you know, I guess what I'd say is that the further we get away from 1920s and the 1930s, the more that period becomes a matter of Soviet or kind of family mythology. And they're really bits and pieces, right? Very little remains of what passes on, right? Because people don't have kind of extensive records about their own families, especially if there's emigration involved, right? And you're displaced and then kind of other things intervene. And so, you know, again, I'm trying to write a kind of dispassionate scholarly book that's trying to be, you know, a kind of cultural history. I mean, well-written, I think, right? So it's not a dry book by no means, at least that's my hope. But it's, you know, fascinating for me to talk to a reader like you, right, who then can kind of look at it and see that, you know, maybe what I'm trying to do here is that the Soviet Jew in some ways shares traits with my great-grandparents, right? So that's not at the forefront of my mind. Like, you are not the only kind of reader I'm trying to address, but it's exciting, right, that it can happen this way. And I think I want to circle back here to a question about why write about literature. I mean, I think that's why, right? It's because, you know, your great-grandparents come from Kharkiv and from Minsk, right? And someone else's might be from other parts of the former Pale. It's a kind of composite picture by the time we get to you, right? You're what, like Gen Z slash maybe young millennial. You can't get a precise story exactly, but maybe this kind of composite picture that emerges from, you know, literary texts that are about Minsk and that are about kind of Ukrainian-Polish borderlands and that are about, you know, other places or whatever, might give you a sense of like what might have come before the shared traits with your own ancestors.
And also in that vein, you know, I also want to ask you, as you were researching and translating and writing for this book, was there anything you took away that sort of helped you understand where you are in your family's story, you know, and or also in the broader sense of understanding sort of today's Jewry and the state of things more broadly?
I think I may be in acknowledgments. One character that I mentioned is my great-grandmother, Mira, who was born in Trstenets. There are several places called Trstenets in Ukraine. So this is Trstenets near Vinnytsia. She was born in 1910, and I knew her growing up. I was almost 13 when she died. I was born and my parents were born and most of my grandparents were born in Ufa, in the middle of Russia, in the Urals, which is not uncommon for many Soviet Jews. But most of the way in which we think about that kind of story, displacement somewhere into the interior, has to do with evacuations during the Second World War. But this was not the case with Mira, right, my great-grandmother. And this I never kind of, it's hard to piece together the exact story because I don't know it and nobody is there to remember it. But she was in Ufa, from what I can tell, by the late 1920s. And so that to me was unusual and like I couldn't figure out what was going on. So in part, it was by researching my first chapter of the book about pogroms in Ukraine in 1918 to 1921 that I realized that there's possibly a connection, right? That probably her family didn't, I don't think they left right then. It appears that they left later in the 1920s, but I've come across other scholars, most notably Elisa Demparad, who wrote a book called Legacy of Blood, which in many ways is about sort of the legacy of pogroms in later Soviet period, about how the, you know, kind of local animosity between Jews and others after pogroms continued to sort of, you know, reverberate, and that there were refugees, not from the immediate violence necessarily, but also from the aftermath. So like in part, right, when I begin my, you know, academic, cultural, historical work about the Soviet Jew, and I say that the pogroms of 1921 is the foundational event in the making of Soviet Jewry, I'm also seeing that in what I now understand of my story, which I think I didn't before writing this book, right? So the book wasn't motivated by my trying to understand, like, how did my great-grandmother Mira ended up in the Urals? But inadvertently, right, by sort of reading, I sort of, okay, this is probably what that part of the story is, and I'll never know for sure, right? In the same way that, like, in your previous question, you also can't quite know. So yes, like, I have to rely on this, you know, weird archive of literary texts, right, to piece the story together.
So the last question I have for you then is to potentially to lead off on something a little bit lighter, but still sort of in that vein of, you know, what's maybe your favorite or most unique thing you found while you were writing this book? What's the thing you point to and go, that's really cool?
Oh, it's a lovely question. So yeah, and I can tell you there's several, but I'll tell you one. So one thing about writing this book is that I really did ignore it for years and tried not to work on it. In part, I convinced myself that I didn't have to because it took me a while to kind of land a job where I needed to write it for tenure. And in part because I really was confused about what it was about. So when I got back to it, it was around these kind of aha moments that I got myself excited about writing it. And there's one in particular that is just like, what is my kind of favorite story about this book? In my second chapter, which is about Minsk, my kind of text for that chapter is a novel by Moishe Kulbach, also a Yiddish writer, called Zelminyaner, which is about this multi-generational family living on the outskirts of Minsk. And Minsk is becoming a Soviet city into the sort of middle of the 1930s. It's a comic novel. And at one point, the protagonists of this family, the entire extended family, go to the movies. The text doesn't tell us what movie they saw. I mean, it's a novel, right? It could be just a completely made up thing. But one of the people who goes to the movies is a tailor. And then he comes home and he thinks about the characters that he saw and he begins to empathize with them. And he imagines sewing warm clothes for them because they are travelers on icebergs in, you know, beyond the North Pole, and there are polar bears there, and it's very cold. And I'm like, okay, well, what it is, you know, what is going on? Like, so it was kind of was the question was on the back of my mind when I was researching this book. Then I was in Minsk reading things, including I decided I'll read Daily Press from the years when this novel was serialized, because so much of it seems to be connected to events that were actually happening. And indeed they were, right? So I traced this kind of timeline, basically, of events in the novel that are correlated to things that were actually happening in Minsk. One of the events that I correlated was the launch of the light rail system in the city, which the papers were obsessed with in 1929. And indeed, the protagonists of the novel, how do they get to the movies? They take the tram, right? They take this light rail that has now come to them, right? It's been sort of extended to the outskirts. And so I was reading the listings for films as well in the daily newspapers. And it was this like archival moment of this like, aha, right? So that the same week I discovered by reading the newspapers as the tram began to run in the city of Minsk, one of the movie theaters was showing Nanook of the North, this kind of legendary, it's thought to be a documentary, but really isn't, by Robert Flaherty. It was made in 1922, but it was filmed in the Canadian Arctic, and it was about the Inuit. This is what they saw. Like, this is the film they went to see. And I'm like, wow, this is so crazy and cool. And I'm like, okay, well, then, like, what do I do with this? Could be a fun tidbit, right? Okay, they went to see a film I identified. But then I sort of began, you know, this is how I began to unspool this thread of how the film is what scholars later have termed salvage ethnography. That Flaherty, the white man, right, the ethnographer who made this film, knew that the culture he was filming was disappearing. And he made the protagonists of his film reenact practices that they weren't living already at that point, so as to preserve them as quote-unquote authentic on screen. Moishe Kulbach, the writer of this novel, had a day job of editing ethnographic publications in Yiddish that were coming out in the Belarusian Academy of Sciences that had a Jewish department that were ideologically driven by the kind of Marxist social science and they were studying Jews, like the protagonists of his novel, with an eye towards understanding how they could be Sovietized. So when I put these pieces together, I realized that the novel that I'm reading and that the novel that I'm writing about is a kind of pseudo-ethnography, a kind of mock ethnography, right? That's trying to show us not what is supposed to happen to Jews in the Soviet Union and how they become Soviet, but instead try to give a kind of fictionalized, right, but possibly truer account of what they were actually going through, right? Not simply abandoning kind of one way of being Jewish and becoming something else, but going through some period of very unclear evolution where things were mixing in these really weird and unpredictable ways and how they became Soviet Jews. So that, what to me was this, like, this discovery was very cool. Like, I remember, it's like one of these ones where you feel like chills down your spine. Like, I can remember exactly the place where I was. I can describe the reading room where I was reading this. When you realize that, okay, like, you know, these people, yes, they're fictional protagonists, but like they had a life, right? They lived a life that I can imagine, right? I can imagine them taking the tram to the movies and having this reaction and maybe recognizing themselves, right? In people who are really not like them at all. And that, in many ways, is a kind of possibility of, you know, literature and film and fiction.
This has been this week's The Jews Are Tired podcast. I'm Lev Gringaus. Don't forget to subscribe and share. And hopefully next week, the Jews will get some rest. The Jews Are Tired is a product of Jewfolk, Inc. For more information, go to tcjewfolk.com or email the show at podcast@tcjewfolk.com. A link to the transcript of this episode is available in the podcast notes, along with links to any news, stories, or reports referenced for this episode.